From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier this week when Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris released her Medicare for All health care plan. The California senator is also a co-sponsor of opponent Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill, along with several other presidential candidates. Under his plan, all Americans would be covered by government-administered health care. Meanwhile, Harris is talking up the differences between that plan and hers, which includes a role for private insurance and new taxes, she said, would pay for the Medicare for All system. We'll discuss both of the plans this hour and a key question that surrounds these kinds of plans. Can we afford Medicare for All? Well, new research published last week in the Annals of Internal Medicine shows that universal coverage might increase costs because when people who are uninsured get coverage or better coverage, they're more likely to use more health care. Researchers who published the study say that with that in mind, and with about 10% of Americans gaining coverage under such plans, U.S. healthcare spending could further swell well beyond its current $3.5 trillion a year cost. But at the same time, the implementation of Medicare in 1966 and the Affordable Care Act earlier this decade did not necessarily cause an overall increase in hospital use. The newly covered did receive more care, but the increase in low-income seniors seeking care was counterbalanced by younger and wealthier people visiting the hospital less frequently. And so does that mean that Medicare for All could provide for those who need it and currently don't have access without necessarily increasing cost? Our guest this hour can help us understand, and really another key question here, which is when we talk about M4A, Medicare for All, are we really talking about Medicare? Are we talking about the same thing from plan to plan, or should we be using different terms? So there's a lot to discuss this hour. The chair of the campaign for New York Health is Mike Sportello, who's back on the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Rohith Pali is a PhD candidate and vaccine researcher at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'll start with you, Mike. You know, earlier this week, you heard a lot about Medicare for All, every Democratic debate. A lot of different plans, but a lot of them are called Medicare for All. Are you comfortable with that term, or do you think it's become politicized now?
I think the term Medicare for All has become a little politicized. Originally, what the word meant is if you are a human being, if you are a fellow Rochesterian, if you're from Florida, if you're from California, I don't care who you are, where you're from, if you're a human being, you deserve health care, and we are going to make sure you get it. And we're not going to let for-profit insurance companies like those that currently operate in New York and elsewhere to skim profits off the top. Medicare for All used to mean that everybody pays in and everybody gets health insurance as a result. More recently, several politicians have used the phrase Medicare for All to continue to allow for-profit health insurance companies to skim off the top and make some profit off of your children's disease, off of your own disease, and off of your parents' disease. And I was lucky enough to be on your show a few weeks ago, Evan,
yep.
And I had mentioned that the CEO of Excellus had an 11% raise this year from $2.2 million to an even greater salary during this time of great uninsurance in our state. I was actually a misquote. It's actually his salary went up by 23%, not 11. So these CEOs that are profiting off of our children, off of our parents, off of our family members for this for-profit insurance that we pay for, they're actually getting raises when New York State has a 6% uninsurance rate, and 3% of our children in the state are still uninsured. That's unacceptable.
Well, thank you for correcting the record on that. But let me ask you, would you set a baseline when we talk about Medicare for All? If private insurance is included, would you say you can't call it Medicare for All?
I would agree with that. I think you should call it something different. I think you should call it a health program that's pretty good, but you're still letting people make money off your kids. I think that's a pretty good way to call it.
I doubt that has the same political heft.
I think you might be right.
I don't think we're going to see that. Rohith Pali, how do you feel about, so far, what we've seen about sort of the landscape of these terms, Medicare for All being kind of the catch-all right now?
Yeah, so I agree with Mike that Medicare for All was a term that was really popularized by Bernie Sanders, but initially referred to true single-payer systems that had universal coverage paired with a single program, which both contains costs and creates equity across the system. And allowing a fragmented system to go under the same name isn't really accurate or fair. And so I think if you want to call it Medicare for All, it has to be a single plan that covers everyone. I mean, that's for all. And a single government-sponsored plan like Medicare.
Okay, so what would your baseline? Would you set a similar baseline that Mike would set in terms of whether we're going to be able to call it Medicare for All?
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. So listeners, I see the phone ringing already. If you've got questions or comments as we talk about these various competing plans, the history of Medicare, the history of how we've done healthcare in this country, and the possible Medicare for All future and what that might look like under these different plans. The number to call is 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program. It's connections@WXXI.org. So Kamala Harris is out with her plan this week. And what? Rohit is smiling. You really like the plan, I guess. Oh, I misinterpreted your smile. Why are you smiling?
It's just, it's an interesting plan. It's the newest.
It's the newest plan. Okay. Mike, you've got a bit of a strange grin over there, too. Kamala Harris, Senator Harris has a plan. She calls it Medicare for All. What do you call it?
I call it better than what we currently have, but not good enough. And there are two reasons I say that. The first reason is right now, as I mentioned, 6% of New Yorkers are uninsured. And with her plan, within 10 years, we'd get close to 100%. Really, 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 really close. And that, I think, is laudable, and I think that's really great. But compared to the other plans in the field right now, plans by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and even our state-level Medicare for All plan called the New York Health Act, which we'll get to later in the program, actually get to 100% insurance within 2 to 4 years with no copays, no deductibles, and everybody, rich, poor, those of us lucky enough to be in between, get their health care. Harris's plan does a couple things that I don't particularly like. The first thing she does is allow out-of-pocket expenses. I have the privilege of serving this community by working at clinics throughout the city. In fact, I was just there last night. And many of the people we see are uninsured. Her plan would fix that. What her plan wouldn't fix is their deductibles or copays. And many of the patients that are uninsured would actually still have to pay large sums of money. $40 deductible or $40 copayment or $200 deductible, that's a lot to some families, especially it's for something that's quote-unquote no big deal, like a respiratory disease early in the process. But something like that may actually prevent them from being allowed to go to work the next day. And you can imagine how this might spiral out of control for a low-wage worker. She also allows for-profit insurance companies to continue to operate in the market. In a true Medicare for All-style plan, like the New York Health Act at the state level, that would make sure that there are no people skimming profit off the top of our you going to see your doctor, your nurse practitioner, your nurse, etc. Her plans would actually still allow that. And I don't think that's just. I don't think that's right. I don't think anyone should be profiting off of your grandmother being able to afford her pills or yourself being able to go see a doctor.
Let me bring in Rohit before we get to your phone calls, because they're already piling up, and that's great. There's a lot to talk about this hour. I think the last time Mike was here, Rohit, you know, one of the things that came up was this question of high deductibles. And the latest numbers I've seen showed that between 40 and 45% of Americans who have private insurance have a high deductible now. And that number has gone up steadily under the Affordable Care Act. So my view of that, I'm trying to be as objective as I can here. I don't have sort of a dog in this fight, even though I don't think dogs should be fighting. But I think if you've got a high deductible health plan, if your deductible is $6,000, what you have is catastrophic care. But catastrophic means different things to different people. So your deductible might be somewhat catastrophic for you, even if you don't have a $70,000 or a $100,000 broken leg or whatever the case may be. Regardless, I think if you have a high deductible plan, what you probably have is catastrophic care, not really just normal health care. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's totally fair. And even after the implementation of the ACA, medical costs still contribute to almost half of bankruptcies in this country. And that's, you know, that's a really sad statistic, because these are people that are getting sick and trying to get better. And just because they tried to get better, they're losing everything. And I would add to that that to these systems, it's really important not just to think about coverage, which almost every plan would very quickly come to 99%, 100% coverage, to think about actual access to care. So are people, if they get sick, will they be able to go to the doctor and not lose their house, like, and be able to continue their lives? And to me, that's like, that's the one of the most important questions to ask when evaluating a healthcare system or a plan for a healthcare system.
All right, so listeners, let's start working through some of your feedback, and I'm going to start with Jack in Greece. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, some thoughts, personal experience with medical coverage. I'm now retired at this point, and I'm thankful that I am on Medicare, so I've seen my premiums drop based on what I had with my employer's insurance, health insurance. And my coverage has improved. But I think, you know, as I reflect back and look at my children and my grandchildren, Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
Sorry, I got a beep. The fact is that we're seeing, you know, we're in the midst of an election. Unfortunately, in my personal view, is that if we get bogged down, or the Democratic Party gets bogged down, and maybe that's not what this conversation is necessarily about, but that we have very extreme opinions in our country today. There's a great divide, as everybody knows. So it's easy to get labeled as a socialist. I think in our country, to leap to Medicare for all leads to the label of socialism. And I don't think that that policy today would succeed. I think my personal view is that we're seeing pre-existing conditions, which President Obama got protected when he put his plan together, but we're seeing it undermined by the current administration. So I'm concerned that if we stick to let's go for coverage free for everybody, call it whatever you want to, but Medicare for all, we have a good chance of losing, not have, and seeing the continual decline. My personal experience is my health care coverage became my most expensive line item in our budget, more than my house, more than all my taxes. It was health care coverage, cost the most. It's now at least not the most because of I'm on Medicare. But I'm concerned that we will lose that if we push for that today. I think it should be an incremental move. People, there's a lot of verbiage around about Medicare for all, but it's really to get numbers on it and what it's really going to cost and how it's paid for, that's going to take time to move people. And to throw it in the middle of an election, I'm not sure it's a winning argument. Anyway, those are my views. Thanks for listening.
Jack, thank you. And Jack's view is, and I don't want to speak for a senator, but largely shared by someone like Senator Sherrod Brown, who considered a presidential run and wants an incremental move in the direction of Medicare for all. Medicare starting at age 50, for example, is one of the proposals that's been out there. So let's hit this in a couple of different ways before we get back to other phone calls, because he's raising a number of different points. Number one, he's concerned that if you go for too much too soon, you lose it all. What do you say to that, Mike?
That's what we told Martin Luther King Jr. That's what we told the abolitionists in 1860. When you're talking about justice, when you're talking about the progress to something that we need to get to because people are hurting, you need to, I think, in my personal opinion, you need to prioritize the people that are most affected. I can tell you right now, the clinics I go to in Rochester, every day we wait before we give these people a true access to the healthcare system is one day too long. To be frank, my insurance, it's not great. I can live the next week, years, decades. I'll be fine. I currently have a stable job and I plan and if things go according to plan, that will probably continue to be true for someone like me. What I can say is that for 6% of New Yorkers, every day they wait is another day that they are exposed to serious danger because they're uninsured. And like you mentioned, 40 to 50% of us have high deductible plans, basically catastrophic care. I don't think we should be waiting for those people either. So whether or not you think it's politically advantageous to wait, I think that is a really good point. And I would argue that Medicare for all is actually pretty popular. When it becomes unpopular is when you start asking, how are you going to pay for it? And we'd love to answer those questions today. But if you ask those questions of what we spend on wars, of what we spend on other popular programs, like what we spend on roads, what we spend on Medicare for 65 and older today, Social Security, et cetera, you'd get the same response. People aren't sure how they feel about it when you start asking the deeper questions.
We have a different caller, and we'll get to Sam in a moment, who wants to talk about the question of paying for it, or maybe take it from a little bit of a different perspective. But, Rohith, what would you say to Jack, who clearly is concerned about an erosion in the quality of care, but sees a couple of different paths forward here? I mean, Jack is essentially arguing that even if you're right, even if he agrees with you in spirit, if you lose on the political side, you'll take the status quo and it will get worse. All the bad things that you see right now get worse if you go the route that you're going. That's how Jack sees it. What would you say, Rohith?
I'd say that the American people, we have to trust them to see the truth. And the truth is that this is the best option. And if you ask them in the polls, so when you spin it negatively, you say, oh, it'll cost each person this much in new taxes, they're against it, of course, because you've spun it negatively. Then if you spin it back to the neutral and you say it costs this much in new taxes, but that's still X amount less than the premiums you're paying now, then they're back in support of it again. And so I think we shouldn't shy away from the challenge of educating people about the issues and helping them to really understand why it's a better system.
And for the folks at home, the numbers he's referencing are, I believe, from the Kaiser Family Foundation. These are easily Googleable. We encourage you to look this up yourself. We want to be very open where we're getting this information.
Do you think that there is something instructive about a moment like we saw when Senator Bernie Sanders held a town hall on Fox News and got the audience cheering for the idea of Medicare for all? Is there something instructive about that?
I think so. I mean, I can tell you that, like I mentioned, the people I see in clinic like this, my friends like it, my older family likes this, my younger family likes this. Everybody loves the idea of actually being able to go to the doctor when they need to see a doctor. The only thing people don't like is they say, there are people, I haven't met them, but I'm sure there are people that don't think this is a good idea. Well, as it turns out, most people, most independents, most Democrats, and almost a majority of Republicans actually support this plan.
Let's get back to your phone calls, and let's go to Sam in Rochester with some thoughts there. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you, Evan, for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the first questions I heard you ask was, how are we going to pay for it? Now, you take Ben Carson, who is the head of HUD. He spent $12,000 for a dining room set. If we cut out all the waste that this administration has perpetrated on the people with vacations and vacations for their friends, that will take care of the cost. And we know that people go to the hospital, and when they go to the hospital, that money is going to be paid for those people that go to the hospital some way, somehow. So why don't we do Medicare for all, and we have it recorded in the record so we can make allowance for it? But we have to stop all this unnecessary spending that this organization has done with all the people that he has brought into office. Don't hang up on me, because I want this to be known. If we just cut out all the waste that has been perpetrated on the taxpayers, we have the necessary money to pay for Medicare for all. I just went through my cancer treatments not long ago, and I had to pay, and my co-payment was over almost $3,000 for my co-payment for my cancer treatment.
I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you for sharing that.
How are you doing, Sam? How are you doing with your treatment?
Well, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. Healed, okay. Delivered, made whole, set free. God bless you.
I am thrilled to hear that, Sam. And even though I don't know that you and I have ever met in person, I hear your voice a lot on this program, and I hope to shake your hand and congratulate you on that. But I want to also respond to your concern about the numbers on cost. And let me from a journalist perspective kind of lay this out there as I see it, trying to guide conversations about this. We have some listeners who their first question is, well, how are you going to pay for that? And we have some listeners who say, that is almost irrelevant. It should be a human right. And I get both of those perspectives, and I get all the different flavors in between. I understand the idea that we're in an industrialized society, and we can decide that people ought to have health care, and that's it. They're going to get care. That is a value that we choose as a society. The resources are there. We will find the resources. We will not live in a way that allows people with means to get good care, good elective care, good cancer care, and people without means not to, or even people without means to be scared to go and pay a deductible. We're not going to do that. I understand that. Well, the reason I bring up cost is simply to say there are a lot of competing claims out there, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris and others. And when they talk about cost, it's often associated with, for example, Elizabeth Warren's talking about her kind of a mega millionaire's tax. Any money that you have that you make past $50 million, she wants 2%. So 2 pennies on every dollar past $50 million. And there are enough Americans with that much money that the federal government would have a lot more. Now, she says you could pay for healthcare, you could pay for higher education, you can wipe out student debt and still have a little bit of money left over. All I'm asking is, does that line up? Because it's not just healthcare sometimes, it's looking at other priorities. That's why. I think it's valuable to know that, because if you get into office and it turns out the math didn't work, then maybe you can do one thing but not another thing. So I think those are valuable questions. But if you want to assert, Sam, it ought to be a right, that's an argument. But that's fair. If you're saying, I don't give a damn where this money comes from, we're going to do it, that's an argument. I hear that, and I'm really glad that you're doing well, Sam. Now I'm going to turn it over, and I'm going to start with Mike Sportello, chair of the campaign for New York Health. Go ahead.
On that note, I think it is important how we pay for it. And because many of the things that we've done in our society today that I think generally speaking, most people agree are good, Social Security, the fact that we get to drive on roads, et cetera, we've chosen to tax all the people of the United States in a certain way to make it happen. I think it's finally time to tax people that make about $500,000 or more in order to pay for healthcare for everybody. That's what the New York Health Act does. So the New York Health Act is a state level bill that provides Medicare for all. So everybody gets healthcare they need, and we do it by taxing everybody in the state, but you will be actually coming out ahead paying less in premiums, deductibles, copay than you pay in taxes, unless you make $500,000 or more. And so what it comes down to is, who are we taxing to pay for this? And I think, Evan, you brought up a great point. I think we tax the people that have been lucky enough to receive such great salaries and can provide a little bit more for those that are a little bit less lucky in life in that manner. Okay. And that's what we propose. So and if you Google the RAND Corporation New York Health Act, you'll discover a big economic analysis, nonpartisan, that lays all of this out. It's a couple hundred pages. There's a short version that's 15 pages that's easily digestible. I encourage all of the listeners to Google that.
Rohit, what would you say to Sam?
So I'd like to first point out, just reinforce what Mike was saying, that this RAND report is really the middle line. There's a report from the University of Massachusetts, which predicts much lower costs, and there's a report from a think tank I will not name, funded by the Koch brothers, which perpetrates much higher costs. But both sides break everything in their direction, and the RAND report is very middle of the line. And then about the costs, I'd say that these are two separate issues. We do need to pay for everything that we do, but we can have separate conversations about what's worth paying for and how we should pay for all of the things we pay for. And I think it's important to have a conversation about how we pay for the things that we pay for. Should income taxes be even more progressive? Should we have a wealth tax? Should we have more taxes on things we don't want, like we have cigarette taxes now? But fundamentally, we first should decide the things that are worth paying for, and then decide what methods suit us to pay for those things. Rather than saying, oh, if you want something, if you want to provide a right, now you need a specific tax proposal.
Okay. Back to your phone calls, and I'm going to go to John in Webster next. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Thank you. I was born and raised in England under the socialized medicine, as people call it, universal health care. It's fantastic. I came to America when I was 23. I'm now 80. I never had much insurance. When I was 65, I went on Medicare. And I also bought a secondary policy, supplemental, with Mutual of Omaha. I got the Golden Plan, Plan F, and I paid up premium every month. But since age 65, well, I'm facing my 13th surgery on the 9th of this month. And between Medicare and Mutual of Omaha, they've spent slightly over $500,000 on me. Cancer, spinal problems. I have a spinal cord stimulator from Boston Scientific. On the 9th of the month, it's going to be removed and a much better one put in there that Medicare's approved. So I will hopefully be out of all pain. I can't speak loud enough for Medicare. It doesn't pay for everything, and that's why I have a supplemental policy. But I've never spent a dime in those 15 years. Mm.
John, I hope you're well, and I'm glad you called. Thank you, as always. Thanks for the phone call. Some thoughts for the guests on that?
Yeah, I hope things are going well. Thanks so much for calling in. And you bring up a good point about supplemental insurance that many people choose to buy today once they age into Medicare. And under the current Medicare for All proposal at the state level called the New York Health Act, as well as a national one called House Resolution 1384, Medicare for All, by Pramila Jayapal, neither of them allow for deductibles or copays or coinsurance. And so that is hopefully we'll be able to help people like our last caller that has had a lot of had to buy, first of all, supplemental insurance and won't be necessary. And second of all, did have a lot of out-of-pocket expenses. So thank you for sharing that personal story. We really appreciate it.
Let me read just a quick pile of email before we get back to phone calls, which we could probably take for the rest of the weekend. Carrie says, it disgusts me that there are people who think that Medicare for All is too expensive, but it's okay to give corporations tax breaks, or it's okay for us to spend, and she calls, excuse me, insane amounts on the military. She says, we have the resources, we just need to allocate them properly. Then we hear from Brian, who says, with Medicare for All, will doctors be allowed to create private practices that attract wealthy patients who pay annual fees for medical services? The idea is for patients and doctors to avoid dealing with insurance companies and government-run programs. I was unable to continue seeing one of my doctors who no longer accepts private insurance.
That's a really good question. Thanks for bringing that up. So under the New York Health Act, the state-level Medicare for All bill, or the national Medicare for All bill, both would not allow any other insurance, and it would make sure that no doctor would be employed by the government. So all doctors, nurse practitioners, nurses would be able to be employed by whoever they want, many of whom would be in private practice, many would be employed by the University of Rochester, et cetera. Now, would they be allowed to choose not to take that insurance? They would be allowed to do that. So the if the doctor said, you know, I'd rather just take rich patients and charge them a lot of money, that's what I want to do the rest of my life. Well, you know, that would be allowed. That would be a small minority of them. We know right now there are a number of clinics that operate in Rochester that are happy to take Medicare insurance, happy to take private insurance, happy to take Medicaid insurance.
But that wouldn't, that we would see some practitioners just taking wealthy clients.
It would be technically legal. And as someone that works in a hospital and as Rohith has worked in the hospital the last 6 years, it would be tremendous. I would be amazed if I could count more than five on one hand of doctors I could ever see that being what they want to do with their practice. Doctors right here, like, as a current medical student, we want to help our patients. And although it is important to take into account one's economic situation when trying to help them out, connect them to services, we don't prioritize our rich patients over our poor patients. There are very, 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 very few people that would ever purposefully choose to do that. And so although I understand there may be a few people that would like to make more money, that's their prerogative.
Don't you think you should be telling rich Americans who are worried about losing the possibility of having a private doctor that those rich people will still be able to get private doctors?
If that is what they choose to do.
I'm just surprised at your PR tactics. I'm just being blunt.
And I mean, there are private doctors right now that, as the emailer mentioned, that do just take cash payments or whatever. There are these new models where you pay every month and then you can see the doctor and there's no insurance. It's just directly to the doctor. And those would still be allowed. They're not insurance plans. And the doctor isn't taking our public plan. So they're free to do that. And those clinics could continue. So there is some amount of that and that will stay the same.
The reason I bring that up, Evan, is because I want to make sure our listeners understand out there. The physicians want this. Nurses want this. The leading organization on this bill is the New York State Nurses Association. The New York Academy of Family Medicine and the New York Academy of Pediatric have also endorsed this New York Health Act bill. So I want to just make sure our listeners understand, although there is a small minority of doctors that may choose to do that, we are in on this with you. We are on the patient's side. We are not on the side of for-profit insurance companies.
So when Mike brings up the state-level bill, again, I want listeners to understand what we're trying to do this hour is differentiate between the different flavors of the so-called Medicare for All bills on the federal level that we're seeing proposed. And on the state level, this is the bill that essentially people like Mike and Rohith want to see passed because there has not been a whole lot of movement toward a single-payer system on the national level. There's a lot of hurdles to get that done. And the question is, you know, so are these quote-unquote laboratories of democracy going to be doing that at the state level? So there is a state bill, yes. And we talked about Kamala Harris's plan earlier this hour. In our second half hour, I will ask the guests on the national level which candidates for president have put together plans that they think really do qualify for the label of Medicare for All. And if you're on the phone, which is like half of Rochester, stay there. We're going to get through as many calls as we can. Got a lot of emails to work through with Mike Sportello, chair of the campaign for New York Health, Rohith Polly, who's a candidate for a PhD candidate and a vaccine researcher at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Right back to your calls next. Coming up in our second hour, an election's happening next week. You're probably not eligible to vote, but the outcome could certainly affect you. There will be a new Board of Elections Commissioner for Monroe County. We're going to talk to some of the contenders who say that this position really matters when it comes to voter access, who's registered, who the access reaches, party neutrality, and a lot more. We're going to talk about it with the candidates next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. As the presidential campaign continues, you're going to hear Medicare for All often, especially in the Democratic primary debates. And our guests in assessing Senator Harris's plan earlier this hour gave that a not quite. I think that their assessment of Kamala Harris's health care plan is that it is better than the status quo, but doesn't go far enough to be truly considered, in their view, Medicare for All. Which candidates do? Just a short list, because we got to get back to the phones in a second. But Rohith, who's on the list?
Honestly, the only bill I would put from the Senate on the list, which most of the candidates come from the Senate, is Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill. But even better is Pramila Jayapal's bill, which has a few key differences from Bernie Sanders' bill. And you know, several of the candidates, including Warren, as we saw in the first night of the debate, have signed on to the Sanders bill and will promote that viewpoint as well.
Okay. Fair enough, Mike. Agree?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. There are a couple people that have signed on to the bill that have since changed their mind. One of them is Kamala Harris. But I think Senator Gillibrand, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Senator Warren have all signed on to that Senate bill.
All right, let's just keep moving. We got a lot to do here. Dorothy in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Hello, Evan. I'm calling to ask the different panelists why. I mean, I think most people can agree that it would be good and the right thing to do for everyone to have health insurance. But some of us are more numbers people, and I want to know why you never hear a number out there. So if we don't change our tax policy, how much would it cost the average American in their taxes, just, you know, like whatever our rate is currently, to pay for a public plan? And also, why don't we ever hear, like, the Chamber of Commerce or private employers advocating for a universal payer system when it's just a major hassle? You know, I worked in a small company where when someone got sick, our rates went up. And we all liked each other, and no one looked poorly at the person who got sick. But, you know, as the company got bigger and bigger, they could afford to pay for less and less of our health insurance as there were more people to cover.
Yeah.
And why is there not a voice from that aspect, that our employers are handicapped by our health insurance costs?
Sure. So, yeah.
You have the bargaining chip when you go to employ someone.
Yeah. So let me do two things here. I'm going to take the last half first, and then I'll kick it over to Mike Sportello to kind of weigh in on Mike and Rohith looking at. I think the question she's asking is, if all things stay the same with the current tax structure, if we want to go to a Medicare for All system, do my taxes go up and by how much? We'll get to that in just a second. Why we don't see the business community? First of all, the business community is pretty diverse. You can definitely find business owners who are very strongly in favor of this. And you can definitely find very rich people like Nick Hanauer who are very strongly in favor of this. You can also find plenty of people in the business community who are very suspicious and are worried that this will lead to higher taxes in some form that will be injurious to business. The last time Mike Sportello was on, he was on alongside some guests from NFIB, National Federation of Independent Businesses, and Unshackle Upstate, which is a group that aims to help businesses in our region. And they're not down with this. They're worried about this. So, but at the same time, that does not speak for all business owners. You can find some. I would probably guess that the majority or plurality of business owners are either neutral or worried about this because of some of the rhetoric they hear. I don't know offhand. I haven't seen the latest polling, but maybe Rohith can help with that. I see him digging into something. You can weigh in that if you like. But Mike, I want you to try to hit her question that I think a lot of people have. All things stay the same. We do a Medicare for All system. What happens to my taxes?
This is going to take 20 seconds to really explain well, so I want to stay with me. The first part of this is it depends how much money you currently make. So if your household earns more than $400,000 to $500,000 under the New York Health Act, you will be paying more. I want to be very clear about that. I'm going to be very open about that. If your household makes less than about $400,000, you will be paying less for your health care. That's after taxes, after premiums, and there are after taxes, and because there are no premiums, deductibles, or copays under the New York Health Act, you will be paying less. That's the short version. Now, you did mention businesses. I want to be very upfront about this. The United States New York State has a number of very competitive businesses, and as Evan, talked about very well, there's a diverse nature of opinions on that. And the reason that I think that there are diverse opinions about that is because the bigger and bigger and bigger your business is, we're talking companies like Amazon, companies like Walmart, that they would actually be taxed under the New York Health Act. But the super small businesses that employ, you know, just a few people selling muffins down the street where you get your coffee, things like that, they actually don't employ enough people for the tax to kick in. And so I would expect them to be in favor of that. So in summary, if you make several hundred thousand dollars or more, you will be paying more. If you're closer to the median, and that's a small percentage of people, and if you're making closer to the median or less, you'll be paying a lot less because there aren't for-profit health insurance companies skimming off the top. And secondly, if you're a business owner, if your business is big enough where you are become a major player and you have a lot more cash flow, I think it is fair that you pay in to make sure that every human in New York State is able to get their health insurance. I hope that answered your question. Did I address that, Evan?
It sounds to me like you did. Rohith, do you want to add to it?
Yeah, I would just, because to ask specifically for a number, if you look in the RAND report, they say we would need to raise $139 billion in additional tax revenue per year. But that is, again, less than what we currently pay in for people under $400,000. It would end up being less than what they currently pay in deductibles and copays.
Because
and
under the
premiums.
Yeah, thank you. Because we don't pay premiums, deductibles, or copays under any of the Medicare for All, under Medicare for All or New York Health Act.
I'm drowning in email. I'm going to get back to the email in a second, but I got to get phone lines open. And so this is in listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio in Geneva. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering about what it maybe your callers can assist me in terms of behavioral health care coverage. Currently, Medicare does not cover outpatient substance use treatment, and also for outpatient mental health services, there's only very limited credentialing that can be reimbursed for by Medicare for outpatient mental health services, and these are in a time of staffing shortages, you have to be a licensed clinical social worker or a physician. There's, again, you know, I could go into that, but I'm wondering if you know how, under a Medicare for All plan, outpatient substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment would be reimbursed.
Well, can I ask a question? Are those covered by Medicaid?
They are covered by Medicaid.
Then under the New York Health Act, they would be covered. Anything covered under as an essential in the current health plans, covered by Medicare or covered by Medicaid, is automatically covered under the New York Health Act.
And so the credentialing requirements under Medicare would be waived?
It would be the loosest among those three that I just listed to start with. And then there'd be a board empowered to expand coverage further.
Do you know whether or not at the national level, whether that would similarly be? I mean, do you know if those other plans, the other plans that are being thrown out there, have considered behavioral health coverage?
Yes. So primarily Jayapal's bill in the House definitely does that. I have not looked carefully enough at the others to know.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's very helpful.
Thanks for the phone call. We appreciate that and hope that helps. Let's get right back to the calls. This is Scott in Palmyra next. Go ahead, Scott.
Good afternoon, Evan and everybody else. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Listen, we've talked about the moral argument on this. Healthcare is a right, and we talked about some of the economic benefits as it pertains directly to healthcare costs. But there's several economic benefits that aren't directly related necessarily. For instance, if you have people who are in jobs that they dislike and staying in those jobs because that job provides some medical insurance, under the Medicare for All plans, they are now free to pursue something else that maybe they would excel in. They would take risks and become more entrepreneurs. You have lots of other economic benefits to that. You have people who would be farmers, which is what I'm interested out here in Palmyra, who can now afford to spend some time on a farm rather than have to make a 40-minute commute into the city to work a job, come back out and drive a farm part-time. You're encouraging other businesses to excel by giving them the security of having health care. So I think that's a very important thing. That's one of the things we were trying to do when we were on the campaigns this year, is just talk about all of the other benefits in addition to having health care.
Thank you, Scott. Some thoughts from our guests on that.
Yeah. I mean, the first thought that comes to mind is a number of the presidential candidates this year have been asked questions by moderators about how they plan to advance the cause for equal pay and gender justice within the workplace. And one thing Medicare for All does is ensure that everybody feels comfortable switching jobs and taking opportunities when they're able to. And this is just one more bit of freedom that would allow anybody to be able to more easily switch jobs if it is a better salary. But once healthcare is off the table, it makes that jump much easier. It also – go ahead, Darhuth.
Yeah, and I think one other important thing is – as we were talking a little bit about it earlier, is the differential effects on business. So right now, large businesses have a competitive advantage over small businesses because they one of the competitive advantages they have is that they have a lot of negotiating power with insurance companies, so they can offer employees better, more comprehensive insurance. But if everyone has excellent health coverage through the New York Health Act, then small employers are at less of a competitive disadvantage against larger employers.
Let me go ahead and keep reading feedback. Gary writes to say the number one reason people go bankrupt in the United States, medical care. No one goes bankrupt in Canada from this. No one. And Canucks live longer and have a higher standard of living. Is Canuck a slur, by the way? Did I just do that? I don't think it is. No. The Vancouver Canucks. You couldn't call a hockey team. Well, actually, that's a bad example. Sports teams have always been called slurs. I'm from Cleveland, for goodness sake. We just got rid of Chief Wahoo in 2019. Welcome to the 21st century. Okay, well, thank you, Gary. Just some thoughts on bankruptcy in Canada. Whew, it's Friday, everybody. Let me continue to read. Nathan says, I'm concerned we already have a significant doctor shortage, especially in primary care. If we do Medicare for All, are you concerned that you will increase the doctor shortage as they are already avoiding whole fields or populations like Medicaid because of low government payment and high debt loads on the doctors? I'd love to hear about how we plan to keep caring and innovative care and providers despite eventually government-controlled payments. Mike.
That's a really big problem, specifically in New York State, and I want to thank you for that, for bringing that up. So the doctor shortage is largely secondary to the main problem. After one goes to medical school, one has to do additional training called residency in order to be licensed. And right now, the federal government does not pay for enough of those residency spots. And so the medical schools cannot admit more people. And so you're not able to train enough doctors quickly enough. And this is a big problem. And you should all be contacting your senators about this all the time. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, what the expanding to Medicare for All does is ensure everybody, regardless of wealth, is able to see a doctor. And so I think I see this actually as a separate issue from that. And although admittedly, this would put some slightly more demand on the doctors, it would also give them a greater opportunity to see even more patients in some areas. But again, I think this problem is a little bit separate. I think if you're a human, you should be able to see a doctor. And the way to fix the doctor shortage is not to make sure that poor people don't go to the doctor. The way to fix a doctor shortage is to make sure we're actually funding the training of doctors at the residency level.
Alan says, it's interesting to me that the UK national health system was introduced after the war when the country was broke. It was introduced anyway. And think about how many lives it has saved. We can't afford it is often used as a conversation stopper. Jen says, Evan, when you consider the total cost of our current healthcare system, including out-of-pocket expenses, premiums, and copays, the cost to employers for providing insurance, the cost of medical coverage in care and workers' compensation insurance, and the increasing cost of care as we age in a system that treats sickness rather than promoting wellness, we can't afford not to move to a single-payer system. It reduces the cost to individuals. It reduces the cost to providers. It streamlines the delivery of care. It allows providers to invest more resources in hiring clinical staff, and it encourages a clinical approach that focuses on patients and outcomes, not dollars and cents. That's from Jen. Rich in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
I'm coughing, but otherwise fine. Don't worry about me. Go ahead.
I know that there's Medicare for All, but I also
hold on,
I
Rich.
Also would like to
hold on, Rich. We lost you for a sec. Start over. Go ahead.
I said I would like to also go to a system of more of a hybrid thing, like the Canadians, where you have your base coverage that covers everyone, but also have riders where people can also go out and get prescription drug riders. eyeglass types of policies and stuff like that. And also, I think we should change the way that doctors are paid. Right now, doctors in many ways are paid like piecework. And we should change it from piecework to outcomes, like they have at the Mayo Clinic and places like that. I think that's another change that would go a long way into making our system better and more effective.
Can I ask you a quick question, sir?
Yes.
To your first point, why would you prefer to have riders, as you mentioned, instead of just having everything covered?
Because in the end, some of this stuff, I feel that in looking at all the systems around the world, the one that seems to be the most effective is the ones like the Canadian systems, where you do have all your base care and any type of, you know, critical care, everything covered. But things like eyeglasses, you get an amount to have your eyes checked, but they don't pay for your eyeglasses. I think in the end, it has shown to be the most effective. I don't want it just to pie in the sky as much as I want the most effective system. And the research and the data is out there already to support that position.
I can tell you've thought about a lot about this. Thanks for calling in. I guess I can give my opinion about this personally. I see a lot of patients that come in for a work physical and they wind up having chronically untreated diabetes, or they come in and they don't really have good teeth. Well, under your suggestion, that kind of patient would be covered for their diabetes and we'd be able to get them their medicine, et cetera, et cetera. Unless, as you're suggesting, they would need a rider for a special prescription, and that would be an additional cost to that patient, additional barrier to get them all the healthcare they need. And as for their dental work, I don't think Canada covers dental like the Medicare for All bill or the New York Health Act does. And I think dental work is enormously important for everybody. I think it's part of the human body. I think it's absurd it's not covered as part of health insurance. And so for those two examples that I just gave, that's why I believe everything should be covered that counts as healthcare. Maybe we can agree to disagree, but I think that healthcare is a human right, and that includes your mouth and that includes your prescriptions.
All right. So Chris' question on Twitter. Do these bills cover dental? There's your answer. The answer is yes.
And vision.
Okay. Let's get through as much as we can quickly. Michael on Twitter says, question about copays. What do we know about other single-payer systems about copays or no copays? Does a lack of a copay lead to overusage of a system?
So there's a lot of evidence. I can't think of the lead author on the study now, but there have been a lot of careful studies of this topic. And what ends up happening is that it is true that if you give people a copay, it reduces their usage of the medical system. But it is not true that it differentially reduces their usage. That is to say, if you give someone a copay, they're less likely to go to the doctor, whether there's something to worry about or not. And so it reduces overusage, if you want to call it that, or wasteful usage, but it also reduces needed usage of the health system. And also, Americans go to the doctor almost half as much as many other countries in terms of numbers of doctor's visits. It's that our healthcare costs a lot of money, not that we use a lot of it.
Herman in Brighton. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. I have two questions and a quick comment. Most industrialized democracies have some form of universal coverage. Hardly any of them have single payer. I just recently talked to a friend of mine in Austria. He's very happy with the coverage he has. He had some major surgeries. He does pay 50% tax rate, and he's middle class, but he's not complaining. But why is it? Have studies been done to compare the various systems and to try to figure out which one works best or which would be the best fit for the U.S.? And if single payer is so great, why don't those countries have single payers? Usually, most of them have some kind of a hybrid. My comment is as far as the popularity of single payer in the polls that have been done. It depends how you ask the question. If you just ask about single payer, people like it. But if you mention that employer-based insurance, employer-sponsored insurance would no longer be available, it becomes much less popular. And then my last question is, politically, how can we get this single payer plan implemented? You know, when under Bill Clinton, there was an attempt at a health care reform that would have gotten most people covered, there was an all-out effort by the insurance industry to undermine it, and of course it got killed. I mean, they used a lot of demagoguery and propaganda and scaremongering. And why wouldn't we expect that to happen again? The way the ACA got passed is basically the administration got an agreement to buy in from the insurance companies, so they wouldn't, because there's something in it for them. In return, they accepted restrictions that would make it, that, for example, pre-existing conditions would be covered and so on and so forth.
Well, Herman, let me jump in. Let Mike jump in because we're going to run out of time. Go ahead, Mike.
So I'm going to take your questions in opposite order.
You got to do it fast.
The last point you made, how are we going to do this politically? Great point. We now have a majority of people in the New York State Senate that have said they want to vote for the New York Health Act. It's time, when they were running for office, we elected them as a state, and now it's time to hold them accountable. The New York Health Act has passed the state assembly about four times in a row, and the New York State Senate finally has a majority of people that ran on passing it. So you need to hold those senators accountable. Go ahead, Rohith.
And I would add to that in Canada, it passed in one province first, and everyone else saw how great it was for that province, and they adopted it nationwide. New York should be the example, set the example for the entire country, and pass the New York Health Act.
And I do want to briefly just ask, give me your preference. Kamala Harris's plan, which is, I know, not your preferred plan, calls for a 10-year transition to a different kind of a health system. Bernie Sanders' plan, a 4-year transition. What do you prefer?
I prefer the Medicare for All Bernie Sanders bill.
4-year transition?
Yes.
Realistic?
Pramila yes. Jayapal's 2-year transition.
A 2-year transition under the spell Jayapal.
Jayapal.
Okay, there you go. So there's a plan. If you haven't looked it up, more to learn on there. I want to thank Rohith Pali, Mike Sportello for taking the time and working us through the various Medicare for All or so-called plans. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And if you didn't get through an email or phone calls, we'll do more of this. More connections coming up.